Chapter 2. The Cat Steps Out of the Wild. We will never pin down the precise time or place where cats gave up the wild for good. There was no single dramatic domestication event, the brainstorm of some early miller who realized that cats were the ideal solution to his rodent problems. Instead, the cat gradually insinuated itself into our homes and hearts, changing from wild to domestic in fits and starts over the course of several thousand years. This progression probably saw many failed beginnings, as one person after another hand-reared some especially tractable kittens in different locations in the Middle East and Northeast Africa. These people probably bred two or three litters of cats, and then either lost the habit or lost the cats themselves, which reverted to the wild. These false starts would have occurred from time to time over a period of perhaps 5,000 years, beginning when humankind first started storing food for long enough to attract mice and other vermin, some 11,000 years ago. Some might have lasted for just a few generations of cats, while others may have persisted for decades, perhaps even a century or two. However, temporary liaisons such as these leave little trace in the archaeological record, especially where wild and tame cats lived side by side and differed only in their behavior. We have only one well-documented example from this period of a close relationship between humans and cats. In 2001, archaeologists from the Natural History Museum in Paris had been excavating a Neolithic village at Chilorocambos in Cyprus for more than a decade, when they discovered a complete cat skeleton dating to around 7,500 BCE, buried in a grave. That the skeleton was still intact, and that the grave had been dug deliberately, both suggested that the burial had been far from accidental. Moreover, the cat lay within 15 inches of a human skeleton, whose grave also contained polished stone tools, flint axes, and ochre, indicating that this was a human of high status. The cat was not fully grown, probably less than a year old when it died, and although nothing else indicated that it had been killed deliberately, the cat's age suggests that this is indeed what happened. We can only guess at the relationship between this cat and this person, but it resulted in their being buried near to each other. Unlike some dog burials of the time, the human and cat were not placed in physical contact, suggesting that the cat was not a treasured pet. Instead, there was an arm's-length relationship between the two. Yet the very fact that this cat was buried with such deliberation suggests that someone, perhaps the person in the grave or a surviving relative, valued it highly. This single cat skeleton gives us a glimpse into an early relationship between cats and humans, but also poses more questions than it answers. No burials of cats have been recorded from the mainland Middle East until thousands of years later. If cats were fully domesticated pets during this period, some of them should have been buried with the same formality as dogs routinely were at the time. The initial domestication of the cat may just possibly have taken place on Cyprus, and some might have been subsequently exported back to the Middle East to form one of the nuclei that eventually led to today's pets. But we have no evidence to support this idea. More likely, the Cyprus burial represents an anomaly, a very special human and his prized tame wildcat. For the cat to make the leap into domestication, it almost certainly had to become an object of affection as well as utility. Some of the ancestors of today's cats must have been pets in addition to pest controllers. We have little direct evidence for pet keeping of any kind, apart from dogs in the Neolithic cultures of the Eastern Mediterranean, but a number of present-day hunter-gatherer societies practice something like it, which may provide clues as to the process by which wildcats originally became first tame and then domestic. In both Borneo and Amazonia, women and children in such societies adopt newly weaned animals taken from the wild and keep them as pets. Since the habit of creating pets from young wild animals is found in societies that have never had contact with one another, we might consider this a universal human trait. If so, this could account for the possible adoption of wildcat kittens by people on the shores of the Mediterranean, one of which may have been taken by its owner across the sea to Cyprus. The human skeleton buried alongside the cat is that of a man, so pet keeping was possibly, and somewhat unusually, practiced by both men and women at that location and time. If the first cats to live in human settlements were indeed tamed wildcats, they are unlikely the direct ancestors of today's domestic cats. In modern hunter-gatherer societies, young animals taken from the wild, whatever the species, are rarely kept for very long and never breed in captivity. Rather, as they grow and their cuteness fades, they may be abandoned, driven away, or even eaten if they are known to be tasty enough and local taboos allow it. For example, such a relationship exists today between the dingo and some Aboriginal tribes of Australia. The dingo is not a true wild dog, but is descended from domestic dogs that escaped into northern Australia several thousand years ago and became successful predators, rather like the wildcats of Cyprus. Some Aborigines find dingo puppies irresistible and take them from the wild to keep as pets. However, as they grow into adolescence, these puppies become a considerable nuisance, stealing food and harassing children, so they are driven back into the wild. We can easily imagine the affectionate relationship between humans and wildcats beginning in a similar way. The first clear indications that cats had transformed themselves into pets come from Egypt, just over 4,000 years ago. At that time, cats started to appear in paintings and carvings. It is not always clear what species these cats are. Some, especially those without tabby markings, could easily be jungle cats. Indeed, we have evidence that the Egyptians had already been keeping tame jungle cats for hundreds of years. A skeleton of a young jungle cat recovered from a 5,700-year-old grave had healed fractures in its legs, indicating that it must have been nursed for many weeks before it died. There is no indication that these jungle cats were any different from their wild counterparts, so they had not been domesticated in the sense that their genetic makeup had been altered by their association with humankind. Other cats, while clearly striped and therefore presumably Felix sylvestris, appear in outdoor scenes, often reed beds, alongside other local wild predators such as genets and mongooses, making it more likely that they are wild cats than domestic. Even the cats that appear in indoor scenes are sometimes depicted wearing collars and so could be tamed wildcats rather than domestic cats. However, early in the Middle Kingdom, about 4,000 years ago, a set of hieroglyphs, mu in translation, was created specifically for the domestic cat. Not long after this, mu was adopted as a name for girls, a further indication that by that time, the domestic cat had become an integral part of Egyptian society. We see hints of pet cats in Egypt going back a full 2,000 years earlier than this into the pre-dynastic era. The tomb of a craftsman constructed some 6,500 years ago in a town in Middle Egypt contained the bones of a gazelle and a cat. The gazelle was probably placed there to provide the craftsman with food for the afterlife. But the burial of the cat, perhaps his pet, is reminiscent of the similar burial on Cyprus some 3,000 years earlier. In a cemetery at Abydos in Upper Egypt, 500 miles south of the Mediterranean, a 4,000-year-old tomb contained the skeletons of no fewer than 17 cats. Alongside them were a number of small pots that had probably contained milk. Although the reason for the burial of so many cats in one place is obscure, that they were buried with their food bowls indicates that these cats must have been pets. These early pets may have come from stock domesticated locally, or they may have been imported from elsewhere. If cats were indeed domesticated farther north in the Fertile Crescent, or even possibly in Cyprus long before the rise of Egypt as a center of civilization, They were likely traded around the region, possibly as exotic novelties. This theory accounts for the scarcity of evidence for domestic cats in pre-dynastic Egypt. The cats that found their way there would have been valued possessions because their owners had paid well for them, but they might have been too few in number to sustain themselves as domestic animals. Most would have been unable to locate a domesticated member of the opposite sex and would have mated with, or been mated by, a local wildcat or possibly a tamed wildcat. In this way, the genetic differences between domestic and wild cats at that time would have been swiftly diluted by the wild versions, and each subsequent generation would have become less and less likely to accept a domestic lifestyle. The domestic role of the cat in Egypt becomes much clearer over the next 500 years, probably reflecting the emergence of a local, self-sustaining domestic population. Cats sitting in baskets, surely a sign of domesticity, appear in Egyptian temple art between about 4,000 and 3,500 years ago. In paintings dating from about 3,400 years ago, the cats are often depicted sitting, unrestrained, beneath the chair of an important member of the household, often the wife. The animal beneath the husband's chair is commonly, and perhaps not unexpectedly, a dog. In one painting from about 3,250 years ago, not only do we see an adult cat sitting under the wife's chair, but also her husband has a kitten on his lap. Members of the Egyptian nobility were evidently deeply attached to their cats, including the eldest son of Pharaoh Amenhotep III, who died at the age of 38 during the same period. He was so fond of his cat, Osiris Tamyaut, which translates as Osiris, the she-cat, that when she died, he not only had her embalmed, but also had a sarcophagus stone coffin carved for her. Footnote. This stone coffin is now in the Museum of Egyptian Antiquities in Cairo. On its side, alongside pictures of Tamyaut herself and the deities Nephthys and Isis, are several inscriptions, words spoken by Osiris. Tamyaut is not tired, nor weary is the body of Tamyaut, justified before the great God. Words spoken by Isis. I embrace you in my arms, Osiris. Words spoken by Nephthys. I envelop my brother, Osiris Tamyaut, the triumphant. See www.maftet.org/ta-myaut.html. End of note. Almost all of these cats are depicted in aristocratic surroundings, supporting the idea that cats were still exotic pets reserved for the privileged few. We find little direct evidence of cats in the homes of working people at this time. This, however, is largely because the tombs and temples, many sited on the edge of the desert, are so much better preserved than ordinary people's dwellings, which were nearer to the Nile. Luckily, the artists who worked on creating the tombs and temples between 3,500 and 3,000 years ago left behind drawings, presumably done for their own pleasure. Many are humorous and cartoon-like, in contrast to the formal drawings required for temple decoration. Many of these drawings depict cats, some in ordinary domestic situations, and others in more imaginary contexts, such as an image of a cat carrying a pack on a stick over its shoulder, strangely reminiscent of the later English folktale of Dick Whittington's cat. These drawings help to confirm that by this time, pet cats were widespread and commonplace in Egypt. We have good evidence that the Egyptians, as well as treasuring their cats as companions, also regarded them as useful. Some depictions of cats from about 3,300 years ago show them apparently accompanying Egyptians on hunting trips, but these depictions are almost certainly fanciful. We have no evidence of any other culture using cats for this purpose, and just imagine trying to do anything like this with one of today's domestic cats. It is far more likely that cats were becoming domesticated for their ability to keep pests, such as imported house mice and indigenous wild rodents, out of the granaries and other food stores on which the Egyptian economy depended. One such pest was the Nile rat, smaller and chubbier than the more familiar brown rat, but no less devastating. Agriculture in the Nile Valley depended on the annual flooding of the arable land either side of the river, refreshing the soil with much-needed nutrients washed downstream. This flooding would also have driven Nile rats, searching for food and shelter, from their communal burrows up to higher ground where granaries were sited. Footnote. At the same time, cats may have been implicated in the first outbreaks of bubonic plague. Although this disease was later spread into Europe by black rats, its natural host is apparently the Nile rat. Although the disease is usually transmitted from the Nile rat to humans via the rat flea, cat fleas are also sometimes responsible. End of note. Cats would have been useful deterrents against such invasions. The Egyptians seem to have valued cats not only for their ability to keep rodent pests away, but also for their expertise in killing snakes. Venomous snakes were a source of considerable anxiety in ancient Egypt. The Brooklyn papyrus, dating from about 3,700 years ago, is concerned largely with remedies for snake bites and the venoms of scorpions and tarantulas. The Egyptians used both the mongoose and the genet as snake exterminators, but these were individually tamed from the wild. The cat was the only domesticated animal capable of killing snakes. Footnote. Both genets and mongooses are occasionally kept as domestic pets, but these are genetically unaltered from their wild ancestors, not domesticated animals, and consequently difficult to keep. End of note. The historian Diodorus Siculus, recording life in Egypt more than a millennium later, wrote, "The cat is very serviceable against the venomous stings of serpents and the deadly bite of the asp." Clearly, the Egyptians regarded domestic cats as useful protection against poisonous snakes, although we do not know the extent to which this was based on their actual effectiveness in preventing snake bites. Today's cat owner might be surprised to learn that Egyptian cats would have attacked snakes rather than run away from them. Pet cats rarely kill snakes in Europe. The only reptiles recorded to be eaten there are lizards, and in the United States, cats are known to kill and eat lizards and non-venomous snakes. Only Australia has records of cats killing venomous snakes. Many feral cats in Australia kill and eat more reptiles than they do mammals. We have few studies of cats' diets from Africa and none from Egypt, but English scholars working in Egypt in the 1930s reported seeing cats killing horned vipers and menacing, if not actually killing, cobras. It is highly unlikely that cats were ever specially bred to prey on snakes. Mongooses are much more skilled at this, but incidents like these may have made a lasting impression on the ancient Egyptians who witnessed them. Footnote. Mongooses have been introduced to many parts of the world in an attempt to control snakes, especially islands such as Hawaii and Fiji, which lack other predators of snakes. End of note. The Egyptians must have used cats mainly to kill mice and other rodents, both in the home and in granaries, a function presumably too mundane to feature in Egyptian art or mythology. In the next stage of the domestic cat's evolution as a controller of vermin, it encountered a new enemy. The black rat, Rattus rattus. Originating from India and Southeast Asia, this pest had spread east along trade routes to the civilizations of Pakistan, the Middle East, and Egypt by about 2,300 years ago. From there, it hitched a ride on Roman trading vessels, reaching Western Europe by the 1st century AD. Black rats are more generalist feeders than house mice, eating all kinds of stored foods, as well as feeds prepared for domestic livestock. Additionally, they are carriers of disease and were recognized as such by both the Greeks and the Romans. Had cats been unable to control this new threat, humans might well have given them the cold shoulder. However, the cats of 2,000 years ago, larger than today's cats, appear to have risen to the challenge. A peculiar cat burial on the Red Sea coast, 1,800 years ago shows that at least some cats of that era were effective predators of rats. The cat in question was a large young male, typical of the cats of the time, but something of a giant by today's standards. Before burial, it had been wrapped in pieces of a woolen cloth decorated in green and purple beneath a linen shroud similar to that of an Egyptian mummy. However, the cat was not mummified in the conventional way, for its intestines were not removed. Examiners found in its stomach contents the bones of at least 5 black rats and at least one more farther down the gut. It is unclear why this cat died and why it was afforded such an elaborate burial, but it may have been special to its owner because of its champion ratting skills. Egypt esteemed cats for their roles as pets and pest controllers and also endowed them with spiritual significance. Starting about 3,500 years ago, cats became increasingly prominent in Egyptian cults and religion. Depictions of cats begin to feature on tomb walls. Depictions of the sun god occasionally have the head of a cat instead of a human and are referred to as muti. The lioness deities Paket and Sekhmet, the latter also associated with the Karakal, and the leopard goddess Mafdet, although clearly based on big cats known to the Egyptians, nevertheless gradually became associated with domestic cats, presumably because they would have been to most people the most familiar and accessible members of the cat family. Bastet was the goddess with which the ancient Egyptians came to associate the domestic cat most closely. Worship of Bastet originated in the city of Bubastis in the Nile Delta some 4,800 years ago. She originally took the form of a woman with a lion's head carrying a serpent on her forehead. Some 2,000 years later, the Egyptians began to associate her with smaller cats. Presumably, this followed with the arrival of domestic cats in the city, or even a new local domestication. During this period, Bastet still had the head of a lioness, but was sometimes depicted with several smaller, presumably domestic cats as her attendants. Within the next 300 years, some 2,600 years ago, her lion goddess identity apparently mutated to resemble the domestic cat more closely. Originally a simple goddess who protected humankind against misfortune, she later became associated with playfulness, fertility, motherhood, and female sexuality, all characteristics of domestic cats. Her popularity spread to other parts of Egypt, especially during the late period and the Ptolemaic era, 2,600 to 2,050 years ago, as the Egyptian empire gradually crumbled. Her annual feast day was for a time the most important in the calendar, as witnessed by the Greek historian Herodotus. Now, when they are coming to the city of Bubastis, they do as follows. They sail, men and women together, and a great multitude of each sex in every boat, and some of the women have rattles and rattle with them, while some of the men play the flute during the whole time of the voyage, and the rest, both women and men, sing and clap their hands. And when, as they sail, they come opposite to any city on the way, they bring the boat to land, and some of the women continue to do as I have said. Others cry aloud and jeer at the women in that city, some dance, and some stand up and pull up their garments. This they do by every city along the river bank, and when they come to Bubastis, they hold festival celebrating great sacrifices, and more wine of grapes is consumed upon that festival than during the whole of the rest of the year. Presumably, because of their association with this cult, the Egyptians seem to have been extremely protective of cats in ways that may seem absurd to us today. Herodotus reported that when a pet cat died from natural causes, all members of the household shaved their eyebrows as a mark of respect. He even reported seeing Egyptians struggling to prevent cats from entering a burning building in preference to putting out the fire itself. This veneration of cats clearly persisted over time. Some 500 years later, when Egypt was part of the Roman Empire, Diodorus Siculus wrote, If any kill a cat, whether wilfully or otherwise, he is certainly dragged away to death by the multitude. For fear of this, if any by chance find any of these creatures dead, they stand aloof, and with lamentable cries and protestations, tell everybody that they found it dead. It so happened that upon a cat being killed by a Roman, the people in tumult ran to his lodging, and neither the princes sent by the king to dissuade them, nor the fear of the Romans, could deliver the person from the rage of the people, though he did it, presumably the killing of the cat, against his will. In contrast to this behavior, the Egyptians routinely practiced infanticide toward their cats. Herodotus wrote, "They either take away by force or remove secretly the young from the females and kill them, but after killing they do not eat them." This account of a convenient method of population control suggests that by his time, and probably much earlier, domestic cats were breeding freely as a self-contained population, more or less isolated from their wild counterparts, and that far more kittens were being born than were needed to become either pest controllers or pets. To modern sensibilities, this brutally pragmatic culling of kittens may seem callous, but before the advent of modern veterinary medicine, it was the simplest way to keep cats' numbers within reasonable bounds. It is presumably least distressing for the perpetrator to dispose of kittens before their eyes open and their faces take on their characteristic appeal. In societies where cats are useful pest controllers first and pets second, this has remained standard practice into the modern era. Describing attitudes to cats in 1940s rural New Hampshire, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas noted that, "Farm cats, after all, are neither pets nor livestock. When the cat population got too high for a farmer's liking, the cats were simply put into bags and gassed or drowned. To care for a group of animals for a time and then to suddenly round them up and dispatch them without warning is, after all, what farming is all about." Even in the 21st century, acceptable behavior toward cats varies widely. Some people view cats as individuals with rights, but others see them as tools that can be discarded when they are no longer useful. The ancient Egyptians, with their deep reverence for cats, added an additional dimension to cat culture that is abhorrent to us today: the cat as sacrificial object. Cats not only formed an important part of the Egyptian pantheon, but were also ritually buried in large numbers, almost certainly millions. The Egyptians, who placed great emphasis on the afterlife, developed the process of mummification some 4,000 years ago as a way to preserve corpses, both human and animal. Initially, mummification of cats seems to have been reserved for treasured pets. A mummified cat is depicted on the sarcophagus of Ta-Miaut, so presumably this cat had been mummified and the sarcophagus constructed specifically to house the mummy. This practice probably continued for many hundreds of years, but the numbers of cats involved were tiny compared with the millions that were mummified as offerings to various cat deities. The production of sacred animals became a major industry in Egypt between 2,400 and 2,000 years ago. Small cats were by no means the only animal involved. Mummies also included lions and jungle cats, cattle, crocodiles, rams, dogs, baboons, mongooses, birds, and snakes. Sometimes staggering numbers of animals were treated this way. For example, more than 4 million mummified ibis, a medium-sized wading bird that the Egyptians bred in captivity, were recovered from catacombs at Tuna el Jebel and an additional 1.5 million from Saqqara. Modern analyses show that cat mummification was often performed to a high standard, including many of the techniques used for the mummification of human corpses. To preserve the body, the intestines were removed and replaced with dry sand. Once the corpse was prepared, the cat was wrapped in layers of linen bandages. These were often treated with a preservative such as natron, a natural desiccant and preservative that forms on the beds of dried-out tropical lakes. Other times the embalmers used mixtures consisting of animal fats, balsam, beeswax, resins from trees such as cedar and pistacia, and occasionally bitumen brought from the Red Sea coast, more than 100 miles from where the cats were kept. Cat mummies varied considerably in external appearance, presumably reflecting the tastes and finances of the prospective purchaser. Some were a simple bundle, with perhaps a simple string of glazed pottery beads for decoration, but others had an outer layer of linen applied with decorative patterns. A head might have been moulded around and above the actual skull, using clay and plaster-soaked linen, or a bronze head might have been added. Some were crude, but others depicted every whisker. Many were placed in simple rectangular wooden coffins, but for others, cat-shaped wooden caskets were constructed, decorated with plaster, and then painted, and sometimes even gilded. Inlaid beads were used to represent the cat's eyes. Overall, they must have been astonishingly lifelike when first constructed. What is more, the sacrificial cats were bred specifically for this purpose. Remains of catteries have been found adjacent to the temples of all the deities associated with cats or other felids. There is little doubt that these cats were deliberately killed for mummification, since X-rays of the mummies show that their necks had been dislocated and others were probably strangled. Some were killed when they were still kittens, at 2 to 4 months old, while others were fully grown at 9 to 12 months. Presumably, the purveyors of such a commercial operation saw no benefit in feeding a cat for any longer than this, unless it had been earmarked for breeding. The mummies would be sold to visitors to the temple, who would then leave them there as offerings to the appropriate deity. As sufficient numbers accumulated, the priests would remove them in batches to dedicated catacombs, where many remained well preserved until the pillaging of the cemeteries in the 19th and 20th centuries. We will never know how many cats were sacrificed this way. The archaeologists who discovered these sites wrote of vast heaps of white cat bones and dust from disintegrating plaster and linen blowing across the desert. Several other cemeteries were excavated wholesale and their contents ground up and used as fertilizer. Some was used locally, some was exported. One shipment of cat mummies alone, sent to London, weighed 19 tons, out of which just one cat was removed and presented to the British Museum before the remainder were ground into powder. Out of the millions that were mummified, only a few hundred now survive in museums, and these come from a mere handful of the many cemeteries constructed over a period of several hundred years. As such, these mummies may not be entirely representative of the cats of ancient Egypt. Examination of some of the few remaining mummies using forensic techniques has revealed much about the animals preserved inside, providing insight into the relationships that the Egyptians had with their cats. All the cats were mackerel-striped tabbies, the same as the wild Libica. None were black or tabby and white, and none had the blotched tabby pattern more common than the striped version in many parts of the world today. Evidence for such color and pattern variations did not appear in domestic cats until later, and not in Egypt. Each of these changes in appearance is caused by a single mutation that is also common in wild felids. For example, the so-called king cheetah, once thought to be a distinct species, simply has a blotched tabby coat rather than the normal spotted variety. Black, melanistic forms of felids abound. They have been recorded from lions, tigers, jaguars, caracals, pumas, bobcats, ocelots, margays, and servals. In the wild, their black color is a handicap because it destroys the camouflaging effect of their normal coat, so they leave few offspring, and the gene responsible disappears from the population. Footnote: the black panther, a melanistic form of the leopard, is common in the rainforests of southern Asia. Presumably, so little light penetrates to the forest floor that camouflage is not as much of an issue as for a normally spotted leopard hunting in the African bush. End of note. Given this, it seems odd that despite a possible 2,000-year history of domestication, none of these colour varieties are apparent in the Egyptian mummified cats. They all seem to have become established within the next 2 millennia. Perhaps the Egyptians actively discouraged these unnatural cats on the rare occasions when the mutations occurred, possibly for reasons connected with religion. Possibly some of the cats in ancient Egypt were ginger or ginger tabby, torby, mixes. Listen to the section, Why Ginger Cats Are Usually Boys, at the end of the chapter. Some of the wall paintings are a more orange shade of brown than the normal greyish brown of Liebecker, although this may be the consequence of some artistic license or due to yellowing of the pigments over the centuries. Ginger cats are more common in the Egyptian port of Alexandria and the Egyptian-founded city of Khartoum than anywhere else in northeast Africa or the Middle East, suggesting that perhaps ancient Egypt was indeed where the orange mutation originally became incorporated into the domestic cat population, before spreading from there to the rest of the world. Footnote. Neil B. Todd, who collected this data, instead suggests that the orange mutation first arose in Asia Minor, roughly modern Turkey, even though it is less common there than in Alexandria. End of note. Although orange cats look more conspicuous than tabby cats and may seem less effectively camouflaged, today's orange cats can be very successful hunters, especially in rural areas. Once the mutation had occurred, there seems no reason for it not to have spread through the cat population. We also know that the mummified cats were about 15% larger than modern pet cats. In almost every other domestic species, cattle, pigs, horses, and even dogs, the early domesticated forms are significantly smaller than their wild counterparts, mainly because smaller individuals are easier to handle. However, this principle may not apply to the cat, which was small relative to man to begin with. More surprising, the mummified cats were also 10% larger than African wild cats are today. It may be that the Egyptians deliberately favored large wild cats because they were more effective rodent controllers, and that domestic cats have subsequently become smaller as they gradually transformed from full-time pest controllers into pets. The attitudes of the ancient Egyptians toward their cats seem paradoxical, almost unthinkable to modern sensibilities. To the Egyptians, some cats were revered pets, many more were simply pest controllers, used by rich and poor alike, but uniquely, many were bred specifically to be killed as sacrifices. Apart from the last, all this is not very different from the way that cats were regarded in Europe and the United States in the first half of the 20th century. Indeed, the Egyptian habit of having elaborate coffins made for favorite pet cats mirrors today's cat cemeteries. Undoubtedly, the Egyptian association between cats and religion seems the most foreign to us. The worshippers who bought ready-prepared mummies as offerings at the temple can hardly have been unaware of what the contents of those mummies were, for the breeding premises and production line for mummies were both nearby and would have been evident from their smell alone. Presumably, these sacrificial cats were regarded in some way as different than household cats, even though they would have been genetically indistinguishable. Perhaps this was reinforced by their being bred in purpose-built catteries. Cats would have been just as prolific breeders in those days as they are now, and mummy manufacturers would have found trapping young feral cats easy. Since both law and custom forbade this, separate breeding of cats must have been the only solution. It is possible that access to the premises used was prohibited to all but the priests who looked after the sacred cats, which were never seen by the worshippers until the cats had been mummified, thus maintaining a distinction between household and sacred cats, even though they were otherwise identical. The mummies themselves show a paradoxical concern for welfare during life, but no trace of concern for life itself. The procurers of these mummies evidently took great care of their cats, but then killed them in huge numbers. Judging from the sizes of the cats, they were evidently well-nourished. Finding sufficient high-quality meat and fish for such large numbers of animals could not have been easy. Although it is not entirely clear how all the cats were killed, it seems most likely that they were strangled in some kind of prescribed ritual manner. Moreover, although the production of mummies must have been a lucrative business, there seem to have been few attempts to cheat the worshippers. Almost all the mummies that were produced to look like cats actually do contain a complete cat skeleton, even though it would presumably have been more profitable to wrap a bundle of reeds in linen and pass it off as a cat mummy. The entire process seems to have been carried out according to strict rules. These rules protected not only the worshippers from the purchase of fake mummies, but also the cats, which were well fed and cared for, at least by the standards of the time, up to the point when they were sacrificed. The cats of ancient Egypt were likely the main ancestors of modern-day cats, as several of their qualities attest. We have no credible evidence for large-scale domestication of the cat anywhere else in the world before the birth of Christ. These domestic cats had the wildcat's striped tabby coat, so would have been distinguishable from genuine wildcats only by their affection for, rather than fear of, people. Some were pets, certainly in well-to-do households, and most probably in many others. Most would have been useful in keeping food stores and granaries reasonably free of rodent pests. Household cats were venerated, at least during the last few hundred years of Egyptian civilization, as indicated by the illegality of killing them and the rituals performed when one died. From about 2,500 years ago, keeping cats gradually became more widespread around the eastern and northern shores of the Mediterranean as Egypt came first under Greek and then Roman influence. Historians have traditionally ascribed the slow northward spread of the cat to laws that prohibited the export of cats from Egypt. Some accounts even tell of the Egyptians sending out soldiers to retrieve and repatriate cats that had been taken abroad. However, these laws were almost certainly symbolic, connected to cat worship. The cat's independence, hunting ability, and rapid rate of reproduction would have made it impossible for Egyptian authorities to prevent domesticated cats from spreading along their trade routes. As cats spread out of Egypt, they must have come across and interbred with wild and semi-domesticated cats in other areas of the eastern Mediterranean. As the Cyprus cats attest, there must have been tamed cats in other parts of the Middle East for thousands of years before the Egyptians began to transform them into domesticated animals. Egyptian paintings from about 3,500 years ago show cats on board ships, and these cats could plausibly have been either immigrants or emigrants. Between 3,200 and 2,800 years ago, trade in the eastern Mediterranean was dominated by the seafaring Phoenicians, who may even have domesticated their own wildcats as pest controllers, operating out of several city-states in what is now Lebanon and Syria. The Phoenicians probably introduced Libica cats, either tamed or partly domesticated, to many of the Mediterranean islands and to mainland Italy and Spain. The spread of the cat was probably delayed not by Egyptian laws, but more by the presence in Greece and Rome of rival rodent controllers, tamed weasels and polecats, the latter becoming domesticated as the ferret. The domestic cat's migration north from Egypt toward Greece is not well documented. In the Akkadian language, spoken in the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent, separate words for domestic cat and wildcat appear about 2,900 years ago, so domestic cats had probably spread into what is now Iraq by this period. Domestic cats were likely common in Greece, at least among the aristocracy, sometime before this. We know this from coins minted for use in two Greek colonies. They were made about 2,400 years ago, one for Reggio di Calabria on the toe of Italy opposite Sicily, and the other for Taranto, on the heel, and both depict their founders some 300 years previously. Although these were different people, the coins are remarkably similar and may both refer to the same legend. Both show a man sitting on a chair, dangling a toy in front of a cat which is reaching up with its forepaws. That this man is shown with a cat rather than the more usual horse or dog suggests that pet cats were initially unusual in Greece, possibly exotic imports from Egypt, and their possession an indicator of status. A bas-relief carved in Athens at about the same time shows a cat and a dog about to fight, but the cat is leashed, implying a tamed rather than domestic animal. Domestic cats probably became common in Greece and Italy about 2,400 years ago. Some of the earliest clear evidence comes from Greek paintings in which cats are shown unleashed and relaxed in the presence of people. Cats also began to be depicted on gravestones, presumably as the pets of the people buried there. Furthermore, by this time the Greeks had a word specifically for the domestic cat, aeloros, or waving tail. In Rome, paintings began to appear showing cats in domestic situations, under benches at a banquet, on a boy's shoulder, playing with a ball of string dangled from a woman's hand. As in Egypt, cats in Rome were women's pets, men generally preferring dogs. And as Mew had been adopted as a name for girls in Egypt, so Felicula, little kitten, became a common name for girls in Rome by about 2,000 years ago. In other parts of the Roman Empire, cata or catula were used, the former originating in Roman-occupied North Africa. As in Egypt, once the cat had been domesticated, it began to be associated with goddesses, particularly Artemis in Greece and Diana in Rome. The Roman poet Ovid wrote of a mythical war between gods and giants in which Diana escaped to Egypt and transformed herself into a cat to avoid detection. Thus cats became widely associated with paganism, a link that would eventually lead to their persecution in the Middle Ages. As sea routes opened up between the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent and the Malay Peninsula and Indonesia, so cats, for the first time, were transported out of the native areas of their wild ancestors. Roman traders were probably responsible for carrying cats to India by sea and later to China through Mongolia along the Silk Road. Cats were established in China by the 5th century AD and in Japan about 100 years later. Footnote: this rapid acceptance of cats contrasts with the Japanese refusal to admit dogs for thousands of years after they had become widely adopted in China. End of note. In both countries, cats became valued, especially for their ability to protect the valuable silk moth cocoons from attack by rodents. The characteristic Southeast Asian type of domestic cat, lean-bodied, agile and vocal, is not, as was once thought, a separate domestication of the Indian desert cat, Felis ornata. Although archaeological evidence is sparse, the DNA of today's street cats across the Far East, whether from Singapore, Vietnam, China, or Korea, shows that they have the same ultimate ancestor as European cats, Felis libica from Northeast Africa or the Middle East. So do all the foreign, Far Eastern purebreds such as the Siamese, Korat, and Burmese. No barrier prevents domestic cats from breeding with Indian desert cats, but evidently their offspring rarely make suitable pets. Although wildcats in Central Asia carry domestic DNA, their domestic counterparts show no trace of wild DNA. Precisely dating the appearance of domestic cats in Southeast Asia is impossible, and each population seems to have developed in isolation from the others. The DNA of street cats in Korea is fairly similar to that of their counterparts in China, and to a lesser extent those in Singapore. But the cats of Vietnam are considerably different, implying that there has been little transfer of cats between these countries since they first arrived. The street cats of Sri Lanka are different again, more closely resembling those of Kenya than anywhere in Asia, perhaps due to transfer of ships' cats across the Indian Ocean. History paints a conventional picture of the origins and spread of the domestic cat up to the time of the birth of Christ, but this picture is at odds with what we can deduce from biology. Conventional accounts have emphasized human intervention and presume that the domestication of the cat was a deliberate process. From the cat's perspective, a different picture emerges, one of a gradual shift from wild hunter to opportunist predator, and then, via domestication, to parallel roles as pest controller, companion, and symbolic animal. Biologists would observe that at each stage, cats were simply evolving to take advantage of new opportunities provided by human activities. Unlike the dog, which was domesticated much earlier, there would have been no niche for the cat in a hunter-gatherer society. It was not until the first grain stores appeared, resulting in localized concentrations of wild rodents, that it would have been worth any cat's while to visit human habitations, and even then, those that did must have run the risk of being killed for their pelts. It was probably not until after the house mouse had evolved to exploit the new resource provided by human food stores that cats began to appear regularly in settlements, tolerated because they were obviously killing rodents and thereby protecting granaries. As the practice of agriculture spread, so did the cat, encountering new challenges as it met new pests, for example the Nile rat in Egypt and later the black rat in Europe and Asia. The cat had rivals for the role of vermin exterminator. Other carnivores of similar size were tamed, including various members of the weasel family and the genet, and its cousin, the Egyptian mongoose. Of these, the ferret was eventually domesticated from the weasels, and the mongoose, most effective as a controller of snakes, was introduced to the Iberian Peninsula for that purpose by the occupying caliphates as late as 750 AD. These various rivals existed in different combinations in different places for many centuries, and it is not clear why the domestic cat was the eventual winner, with the ferret as the only runner-up. Very probably, cats did not have the edge as vermin controllers. The answer, therefore, must lie elsewhere, possibly in the cat's biology. The connection between cats and religion is unlikely to have been crucial, since Egyptians sometimes venerated both mongoose and genet as well. Most likely the cat managed to become more profoundly domesticated than any of its rivals. However, which was the cause and which the effect? Are cats more trustworthy and predictable than ferrets because they have evolved ways of communicating with humans? Or is it the other way around? Since we do not know precisely how the domestic cat's direct ancestors behaved, such questions are impossible to answer. Nevertheless, the cat's capacity to evolve not only into a pest controller, but also into a pet animal, its present-day roles, must have been central to its success in the first 2,000 years of its domestication. So what set the cat apart on its millennia-long journey into our homes? Here, the cat's involvement in Egyptian religion may well have been crucial. It is possible that the Egyptians' veneration of cats gave the cat the time required to evolve fully from wild hunter to domestic pet. Otherwise, it might have remained a satellite of human society and not an intrinsic part. It is even possible that the factories that produced the cat mummies forced the evolution of cats that could tolerate being kept in confined spaces and in close proximity with other cats, both qualities that are signally absent from today's strongly territorial wild cats, but that are essential to life as an urban pet. Although, of course, most of the cats that carried the relevant genes died young. That was how they were being bred, after all. Some must have escaped into the general population, where their descendants would have inherited an improved ability to deal with the close confines of urban society. Such changes take only a few decades in captive carnivores, as exemplified by the Russian fur fox experiment that turned wild animals docile in just a few generations. Is it possible that today's apartment-dwelling cat owes its very adaptability to the inhabitants of those gruesome Egyptian catteries. Why ginger cats are usually boys. The mutation that causes a cat's coat to be ginger rather than the usual shades of brown and black is inherited differently from other coat colours. In mammals, most genes obey the dominance rule. To affect the appearance of the animal, the recessive version has to be present on both chromosomes, one inherited from the mother and one from the father. Otherwise, the other dominates. Usually, animals with one dominant and one recessive gene are indistinguishable on the outside from animals with two dominant versions. However, there is one major exception. If a cat carries one orange and one brown version of the gene, then both appear in the coat in random patches. In one part of the skin, the chromosome with the orange version has been switched on, and in another, it is the brown-black pattern that wins, producing a tortoiseshell tabby, or Torby cat. The precise colour of the patches depends on other coat-colour genes. If the cat also carries two copies of the black mutation, then the brown patches are black, so their tabby pattern is obscured, like a regular black cat, while the orange patches, on which the black mutation has no effect, are orange and yellow, with the tabby pattern still visible, producing a tortoiseshell or calico. Second, the gene is carried on the X chromosome. Female cats have two X chromosomes, and males only one, paired with the much smaller Y chromosome that makes them male but carries no information about coat color. Thus, for a female cat to be orange, it must carry the orange mutation on both chromosomes. If it has only one, it will have a tortoiseshell coat. Although tortoiseshells are much more common, ginger cats can be female. Almost without exception, males are either orange or they're not. In fact, tortoiseshell males do crop up from time to time. They have two X chromosomes and a Y chromosome, the result of an abnormal cell division. A common misperception holds that ginger or marmalade cats are always male, hence the phrase Ginger Tom.